kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello, and welcome to episode 117 of Today in Digital Education, Tide, the Tide podcast. It is here. You are here. All is well. I am Di Barnes, and...
I'm Doug Belshaw. Di, we haven't done this for about 3 months. I've had people like on Patreon going, is Tide podcast still a thing? I think they've kind of shamed us into doing another episode.
Well, it's been a really difficult thing. We've tried a few times, and like with genuine intentions to get here, and it's just our schedules have been very, very busy with one thing or another. But also, other things have been going on as well that have taken us away from the wonderful Tide.
Well, one thing has taken us away from the wonderful Tide.
We have discovered, this is Doug's fault. I think we talked about this in the podcast. Doug said, Red Dead Redemption 2, Di, it's brilliant. You should buy a PS4 and get Red Dead and we should play. I did that, and we did that.
And so, it is incredible, is it not?
It is really, really good. I really enjoy it. There's it's just a fabulous game. So for people who don't know, I mean, it's Red Dead Redemption 2, so 1 is the same kind of thing. Massive online world of the wild frontier, I guess. And it's just phenomenal. It's just, you're just rocking around. You can go in and play in story mode or online. And online is where Doug and I would play together. But in story mode, you can just go and chill out in the mountains and the valleys and kind of get everything, just go hunting and fishing and stuff like that, running around in your horse. It's really, really cool. I really love it. It's kind of very chilled out. And then you go and fight people. And then that's also quite exciting.
Well, you know what? At different moments, as you know, I have streamed out some of our gameplay on Twitch.
You have, haven't you? Some of which has been very funny and is worth watching.
Well, there's been, I mean, the thing is, for people who aren't gamers and for people who've never played this kind of stuff, it sounds just like a bit of a waste of time and stuff. But it's so, so good. And like, so it's not like Di and I haven't been talking. We've been talking more than usual, you know, during the, you know, we usually do Tide podcast once a week or once every couple of weeks. But when we started playing Red Dead together, Di, we were talking like for a couple of hours, 3 times a week.
Pretty much, yeah. It's like we lived in each other's houses to a degree. And it was quite entertaining in that way, and a lovely thing. But it's so for people who don't understand, the way it works is you have like a layer of audio called a party on the PlayStation, which is separate to the actual game being played. So we're sort of on our horses running around and shooting people together. And then we're having a chat that no one else can hear. It's just me, just Doug and I. And it's kind of cool. So we can have our own private sort of chat, like a phone call, whilst you're pooting about and playing the game. And then someone gets shot in the head and you have to go and take revenge on some other idiot, just like us on the internet somewhere. And it's really good.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is what all the kids are doing. And we're kind of, we've talked on Tide before about how we should just understand that things are different. And this is where kids are congregating and whatever. And actually, in the last few months, my son's gone from playing Fortnite to being banned from Fortnite for a week at Easter-ish. And then him having a conversation with me about whether he actually wanted to be allowed to go back on Fortnite, which I thought was a very interesting conversation. Ooh. Because he understood that he felt and thought differently. And also there was a pressure on him to be good at Fortnite, which he is. You know, his friends all see him as, you know, a particularly good builder on Fortnite and, you know, good shot and stuff. Uh-huh. And so he's gone back on, fully realizing that sometimes he gets a little bit addicted to it. So he's gone with a different attitude. And he's now playing with friends of friends. And sometimes there's like 15, 16 of them. And they're playing not in the main game, because you only play squads of up to 3. They're playing in the sandbox mode. And they've made their own arenas and their own rules and stuff. So it is fantastic.
That is really fantastic. I hope he's a better shot than you are, by the way.
Yeah, I'm particularly bad, yeah.
Okay, well, I think that it is really awesome. So if there is this thing, I've not played computer games properly since for 20 years, pretty much since my children were young. And I'm really, really enjoying it. So the PlayStation 2 is a bit of an annoying device. So I use it as my television driver, as it were, to access all the different things. And
PlayStation 4.
PlayStation 4, sorry, yes. It's PlayStation 2 that I had 20 years ago, maybe not that long, 15 years ago, whatever it was. And But it is really cool. And what's quite interesting is the PlayStation Network has gone down, and that's what I've been sort of a little bit fascinated by, is how such a big network that's being accessed all over the world by lots and lots of people is not robust enough to stay up when it needs to. And then obviously analyzing Red Dead from a computer science sort of angle and how it's all working and the interaction between the multiple players online and all that sort of thing. I mean, it's got a lot of heavy loading time when you're playing against other people, which sort of works because you go and do a game for 10 minutes and then you're sort of chilling out for 5 minutes in between or whatever while everything loads up and gets ready for the next one. Or maybe even a bit longer than that.
Well, it is very annoying though if you're not very good like me and you get killed straight away and then you have to wait 5 minutes for it to load.
Well, it is if you're in that kind of game, and to get your rewards for the game, you have to wait until the end. The game is finished for everybody, not just you. But there are certain games where you get one life, and there are other games where you just keep respawning and joining back in again.
But the history teacher in me kind of really, because there's all of these games. Can you remember, what was it called? The Oregon Trail, where like you died of dysentery and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, no, I can't.
Very simple kind of games. But you can imagine, you know, I used to teach the American West. And even for me, who taught this year after year after year, it really brought the West alive to me. And I just imagine that, you know, if you got kids playing the game while they were learning about the West, it would just... Because there's the railroad in there, you can drive trains by kicking the train driver out. You can learn about the postal system, all kinds of.
That's things. It, and you can go around and be a right hooligan, or you can be a nice person doing good deeds for people, rescuing their kin and that sort of thing, and taking on the baddies. Doug and I are obviously really bad people. Although it was quite interesting because when I was playing it, so I was playing it for a while, just getting used to it before Doug and I played together online, and just for like a week or whatever. And I was getting my, what's it called? That balance, that's thing of goodness.
Oh, the thing at the bottom, the reputation bar.
Yeah. And I was like, mine was on the way to being like the perfectly good person, you know, a good God-fearing Christian.
Is this the story you're spinning now? Like, I'm such a corrupting bad influence.
You were. It's not. I'm not lying here. So I go on, and it's like, you were at the worst. You were like almost celebrating. I am at the extreme of the bad person.
And I had like a massive bounty on my head, and people were coming after me.
Absolutely. And now that's how I live and all of that. Anyway, so now I'm a bad person too, and it's all because of Doug, I think.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah,
but it is pure escapism and just wonderful, but also a really good way to just have a chat, because as we've said before, Di and I, it's not like we'd phone each other up and have a chat on the phone. Like, there always has to be
ever
something that we're doing. So now it's not just this podcast, it's Red Dead Redemption 2. Or we did have a quick go at what was that other game?
Something to do with Sky. One Man's Sky, was it?
No Man's Sky.
No Man's Sky, that's it.
Yeah. But I think it's because Red Dead Redemption 2 is so good and literally seen as the best game of all time, that No Man's Sky, although there's nothing particularly wrong with it, it's a game set in space, again, another sandbox game, it just felt a bit meh.
Mm. I asked one of my students about it, because he's a big gamer, and he knew No Man's Sky, and said he'd played it in the first instance, and it was much better now after they'd done loads of updates. So apparently in the first iteration or whatever, it was all the worlds were quite similar. You fly in a spaceship between different worlds, like collecting different resources and learning about the worlds and then making things out of your resources and blah blah blah. And but it was a bit dull when we were in there, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah. And you know, I think educators especially, if you're, you know, again, if you're listening to this and you're thinking, oh, I'm not much of a gamer, I'm just going to switch off, whatever, like, this really is the future of gaming, because
it is
20 years ago, you know, 1999, then think about what it was like in terms of education. And we had our own like intranets and shared drives and everything like that. And now really almost every school, every educational institution is using, you know, Google Docs and Microsoft, whatever. So more generic things and more like big money commercial things are coming into education. And so I can really see a place for gaming in education, because Fortnite, I was at the Thinking Digital conference last week. The people behind Fortnite, Epic Games, don't call it a game anymore. They call it an experience, because there's gigs going on in there. There's all kinds of stuff. And really what it is now It's an environment in which you can do stuff. So you can imagine all kinds of stuff happening within Red Dead or Fortnite or whatever. It's an immersive experience that you could do almost anything you wanted in, including learning new stuff.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right as well. And I was thinking about this, the sort of access, the reason that I like Red Dead is because it's to do with cowboys, right? And that has a part in my childhood. And so the whole cowboy thing came about because of watching films and Western movies, because there used to be very few channels, et cetera, et cetera. But my children have not got that whatsoever. They have not got that sort of, a bit like fairy tale Disney movie love of cowboys, I guess. But they are going to get that love of those things through games. Because that's how they've been introduced to them.
But I've given the example of history, but you can imagine learning a language through a scenario, because you've got a particular scenario where you've got a partner and they only speak a different language and you're trying to understand them. And like, there's all kinds of stuff you could do.
Mm. So I'm wrestling with this at the minute. So one of my year 8 pupils spoke to his house mistress, his husum, and wanted to get together an inter-house gaming tournament. And they wanted to do it on Counter-Strike, I think the game was. They decided it was pretty cool. And which is a first person shoot 'em up, a bit like Call of Duty or whatever. Yeah. So I found a year 11 for him to write a paper, a proposal to get with. And we went through the proposal and he put the proposal in. The first senior person who saw it said, passed it off to the pastoral senior person, deputy head. And then she said, can we just do it, but only with year 7 and 8 as a trial? And we got to the conclusion that rather than doing a shoot 'em up, because I thought we'd definitely get objections to that, rather than doing a shoot 'em up, we would do Mario Kart. I thought that'd be really cool on a massive display screen in the hall, and have a knockout tournament for a couple of 3 hours on a Sunday afternoon. But it's been sort of kiboshed down to just the year 7 and 8s, of which there are only 120. It's not very many. Yeah.
You don't know why particularly.
I think they just I think it's because the adult generation, so my generation, dare I say, who are knocking around 50 maybe, are just haven't gamed. They don't know what it is. They think it is all about, just like mobile phones, right? It's a very similar feeling to the whole thing, in that they're just they're not scared of it, but they are. What are they? They're just worried that it's a source of addiction, of compelled behavior, of distraction from what it is that they should be doing. Oh,
so they want the kind of Nintendo fluffy version of it for little kids.
It's that sort of thing. And it's, I don't know. I don't know what it is. It's difficult, really.
So Di, tell me how you're known as quite an inspirational teacher, kind of Robin Williams kind of character, if you know, coming in through windows and things.
Captain, my captain.
Yeah, yeah. How's that been going over the last?
All right. So what Doug is obliquely referring to here is that, so I applied for a job at a different school. I won't say where, but in the south of England somewhere. And I put together, we've talked about on here the, what was it? The social credit system, haven't we, in China?
Yeah.
So facial recognition dictating the social credit system. And if you do badly in the social credit system, you're not allowed to go on public transport or stay in good hotels or anything of the sort. And all of that. So I introduced this. So I was doing an interview lesson, and it was for a deputy head position. And in this interview lesson, it was, I'd come up with this idea to introduce the social credit system, and then I introduced the lanyard. I'm not sure if I talked about this in the last episode, actually. Maybe I did, maybe I didn't. And this lanyard thing they have, they're trialing at the Bank of America now. And the lanyard has cameras and microphones and RFID and NFC in it and that sort of thing, different sensors. And so I showed them this, like the snippet of this video and then a snippet of this lanyard at play in the workplace, which tracks your behavior. So it doesn't record what you're saying. It records like the temperature of your conversation. So it records how long a meeting would last, how much you contributed to a meeting, how much you spent talking, how much other people's, and it divvies that up and it starts to basically mine the data or map the data about your behavior in the workplace so that they can work on improving efficiency of your performance. And they also make claims about it's like, you know, how many women get invited to key meetings, how long do they contribute, are they asked questions, et cetera, et cetera. And that's how it's selling itself kind of thing, is that you can check levels of equality and diversity within the workplace as well as productivity. And it's an opt-in basis. Now, anyway, so we talked this in the lesson, talked all this to the students and showed them a couple of videos about, you know, snippets of videos, what it does and explaining itself, and talked about it a little bit. And then I said, okay, this is what I want you to do. And we're going to organize ourselves into small groups of three or four, and you're going to develop a social credit system for your school, whereby teachers can no longer give punishments or rewards. And it's all going to be automated and done through facial recognition based on your behavior within the school building. And, brilliant. So we start looking at what that is and how many points would you allocate, how many points would you reward, what would the punishments and what would the rewards be for when you did, you know, got high scores or low scores, and all of this sort of thing. And the lesson went really, really well. It's, you know, it just sort of it encourages really good discussions to go on and the children to reflect upon it. And I would sort of stop them and say, okay, what I want you to do is write an ethical algorithm here, one that you would want to be governed by. So this is the sort of shoes that I want you to wear when you're thinking about this, is to make an algorithm that would you would be happy with and that you would want to operate under but it would have to achieve its goals, obviously.
Yeah.
And so we did that and lesson went really well. And the guy had got me a sort of a generic Google account to share my stuff with, so I could get the children to share it with that. And then I could put them on the board and go, you know, pick out some pieces of the things that they had identified and discuss them. Towards the end of the lesson. Anyway, this Google account didn't work. And I was like, it doesn't matter. It's not a big deal. And he said, no. So he got all the children to share them with him. Because he said, I want to show it to the head later. I want to show him what you've come up with. And I was like, it doesn't get better than that in an interview lesson. Come on, nailed it. So we're getting towards the end of the lesson and I'm being much like I am now, you know, I just sort of talk with sort of momentum and too quickly and enthusiasm, I guess. And so I got carried away a little bit by the end, and I was asking them, rather than putting it on the board, I was asking them, so what's the key things, what the takeaways from your social credit system, you know, what did you come up with? And they said, you do the thing, if you get to like 800 points, and then you get into a zone where you couldn't get any punishments or something silly like that. I can't remember exactly what it was. And I go, no, you can't do that. Imagine you got to the last week of term and you've got 1,000 points and you're safe, as it were. You could go around, you could be swearing at teachers and you could be jumping on the tables. And with this announcement, I jumped onto the table and started... And there I was, and then I just sort of caught myself standing on the table like Jesus, and I just turned around and saw this old guy observing me in the corner in this interview lesson. Anyway, needless to say, I didn't get that job. But it was very entertaining.
Oh, that is class. Oh, what a lesson though. That would have been I wish I'd been there.
Me too. I wish I'd been there. I wish I'd been in my head at that point rather than getting carried away in my bloodstream or whatever.
Oh, dear.
Anyway, so that was fun. But I found actually the whole interview thing, I think it was probably a culmination or an amalgamation of different things that meant I didn't get the job. So, but I was found that answering the interview questions, I was actually dreadful at it. So I've only interviewed for two jobs in my life. One of those was 15 years ago. No, one of those was to come here where I was told I nearly talked myself out of a job. And then that was 15 years ago. And yeah, so very bizarre. Not a familiar stumping ground for me. So I gave very bad answers. When I came out to the interview, I was on a real high. I thought I'd done really well. And then I realized as I drove home a couple of 3 hours and that
I know, because you'd messaged me and like you were like, I think that went really well. And then like a few hours later, you were like, actually, on reflection, what have I done?
Yeah. No, I just thought, oh my God, I stood on the table during the lesson and I said that to six people sitting there in a panel. They must have thought I was a right doofus. do you know what I mean? So, yeah, it was weird.
So, well, you never have to see them again in your life. It's all good.
No, absolutely. And there's, I mean, people have said that actually to me since, and I've told them the story, and they said, no, you should just apply for loads of jobs. And if you want to get another job, which I don't particularly, I'm very happy where I am. I thought this job was a good job and something good to go for and good for me in my particular situation in life at the moment. I'm not looking to leave because of the situation at my own school, if you like. And why am I saying that? Yeah, they said you should just apply for lots of jobs to go and get interview practice and don't think of it as anything else but that.
Well, the interesting thing is, so Hannah, my wife, she is currently doing some supply, but she wants to kind of, you know, like it's a hard road doing supply. You don't really have colleagues. It's not as well paid as it used to be, all that kind of stuff. So she wants to do something different. And I think the last time, I don't know, I'm tired, I can't remember, but she was thinking about doing cybersecurity. Anyway, she's now going to apply for this other thing, which is a 6-month training thing. It's in the north of England. It's about getting women into tech, but it's much more her kind of thing, like data analyst or, you know, like that kind of stuff. Uh-huh. So she has to, as part of the process, which is interesting, given that I went to a diversity and inclusion workshop last week, which was talking about blind CVs, she actually has to put in her CV and do a 1-minute video. And, she is, you know, terrified about doing this because, of course, I spend most of my day on, like, video conferences and all that kind of stuff. I'm used to seeing myself on video. I'm used to the sound of my own voice for the podcast. Mm. So it's a huge kind of barrier. So I should imagine that in a similar way to getting interview practice, it's just doing it.
Familiarity. Again. Yeah, absolutely. It really, really is. So anyway, we'll see. Moral of the story is if you really want the job, make sure you practice before you go.
Indeed, indeed. Well, you mentioned China there, and Moodle's founder and CEO, so my boss, Martin Dougiamis, he is in China at the moment, and he's in a place called Zhengzhou, and he tweeted, and I'll send the tweet, he says, apart from the usual things, my hotel room tonight in Zhengzhou came equipped with new underpants, socks, tomatoes, fruit, noodles, yogurt, facial mask, mosquito repellent, portable router, condoms, and a full head gas mask.
Oh my gosh, that's crazy.
I know. And interestingly, you know, we're having a bit of a chat on the Moodle HQ Telegram channel, and there's a Moodle instance at one of the universities there. It's got 2 million students on active users.
And 2 million?
2 million.
Oh my gosh.
Active users. And obviously they're doing clusters and all kinds of crazy stuff. Now we noticed when someone sent a link, and obviously I can't read Chinese, but I noticed that it didn't have an SSL certificate. It wasn't HTTPS. And someone joked, oh, well, that's just so that the Chinese government can read everything that people are putting. And I did a bit of a search, and it turns out that's exactly the case. Because if you've got a Chinese website or Moodle or whatever, and you put an SSL cert, and you can put on all you want, but none of the Chinese browsers pay any attention to it.
All right, okay.
So, and the other thing that Martin was saying, just on the Moodle HQ channel, which I'm sure you wouldn't mind me sharing, is that because everybody pays via WeChat, which is that, you know, ubiquitous social network in China, that isn't just a social network, it's your life. Places don't take cash. They just take WeChat. And the only way you can get WeChat is if you've got a Chinese SIM, which you can't buy easily and stuff. So he was like wandering around trying to find food at lunchtime. So crazy, crazy world.
Okay. So you're looking to pay for cash for something. No, it's interesting that it's so prohibitive to joining in, isn't it?
You couldn't find an ATM and you couldn't find anywhere that took cash.
Yeah. No, that's bonkers. But I guess, I mean, that's one of the things about China. So WeChat is enormous, isn't it? So WhatsApp, I think, is getting bigger and bigger. And I use WhatsApp with the people I work with in India as well, who are native to India, if you know what I mean. And so it's like cross-platform in Kenya as well. When we went over there, there's a bit of WhatsApp going on. And WhatsApp is used hugely, but in China, it's not. And WeChat is the thing. And I've read stories about WeChat being used by teachers with their students while their students are at home doing their homework. In a kind of not a kind of nice way, to you know what I mean, in kind of officious, get your work done way. yeah, it's all a bit bonkers.
Well, I tell you what's really interesting. So at this Thinking Digital conference last week, there were all kind. I mean, it's just so inspirational, Di. You'll have to come up sometime and come along.
Yeah, yeah, it sounded good. There were, Simon Finch was helping out there.
Wonderful people there. The sessions are fantastic. Everything, you know, from someone from Industrial Light and Magic talking about the CGI behind Bird Box, to this guy who I wanted to mention, who made shitloads of money in Silicon Valley, English guy, came back and decided to pretty much like find himself. So treated going into the forest and living in a shepherd's hut, but like a younger David Cameron, for 5 days a week and going back and seeing his wife and kids to the weekend. And just think about what's this all about, you know, trying to rediscover himself, and but has got the internet and is putting things out on YouTube, and he's got community worldwide. And so he's basically advocating having dual nationality in the future, having your tribe of like 100 in a global hamlet, he was calling it, worldwide, people who share the same ideas and goals as you, and then your national identity as well. And he put it in a bit kind of like male white privilege kind of way, which kind of turned me off it. But I was thinking about this today, because I've just today, two people have joined my team. So we did have one back-end developer. He's finishing up this week, and we've hired two kind of 0.5 developers. And just onboarding them to Moodle, the first thing you have to do is go, well, I'm really sorry, but these are all the Telegram channels you're going to need to join. And there's lots.
How many are there? Give me a thumbnail number.
Let's just find it in here. Tech. So this is about half of the number that I'm on. And so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So 12 they had to join.
Oh my gosh.
Right. And what? I'm on at least double that, I would say.
Really? And that's all Moodle or just general?
All Moodle.
My word.
But I mean, the interesting thing is these are not all high traffic channels.
Sure.
Some of them are broadcast, some are chat. Some of them are like, you know, when you need to talk to the DevOps people, like, you know, once every 2 weeks you communicate during that rather than by email. So this is the kind of interesting approach, isn't it? That WhatsApp and Telegram and WeChat, they're coming at it from a, you've got your contacts and these are the people, and then occasionally you need to be in a chat with some other people. Mm-hmm. Whereas Twitter and Facebook and, oh, not Facebook, but like Twitter and Instagram stuff start from the other, like, public angle, and then you go private via DM.
Yeah.
And I really do think, given the way the world is now, starting with the people you know and then kind of finding trusted people and joining chats is kind of the way forward, really.
I think that if you think about it, it does make a... They are really, really different services, aren't they? Even though they ultimately end up being quite similar. But where they come from, just for the reasons you're stipulating. So interestingly to me, we're looking at Microsoft Teams as replacing our internal communications at the moment. And then that is in two realms or three realms, really. The sort of admin support staff of our school, the teaching staff of the school, and then the pupils as well. Right. And that's where it becomes problematic, because it's exactly the same as Telegram, as in you have, or not the same as Telegram, but it can be, is where, or like Slack, it's more like Slack, really, in that you have channels and the channel is created, and then you can have sub-channels within a channel of group of an organization of people. And it's a bit like that. And that's and just thinking about how I migrate somebody who is very comfortable with email and understands exactly how it works and it ain't broken kind of thing, going onto a chat app, when really the only problem that I have with email in any way, shape or form is that people spend too long writing them, and they take too long to read. I think people are sort of unknowingly disrespectful in just how long they expect someone to read their email for. So if they send an email that is three paragraphs long to 200 people, that's a lot of minutes that you're eating up of people's working day. And unless you're the boss, then you don't really have the right to do that, I don't think. It's just not sensible behavior.
Yeah, I think you're right. But then you get the other side of the equation, where you get people typing in five different messages in a row, something that they could have thought about and sent one message. Because for people like me, okay, I mute quite a lot of the channels. And that was James and Karen, who joined the team today. One of the things that I appreciate other people doing for me when I join organizations is, you know, giving the lay of the land, scaffolding people's attention, saying, you know, you can safely mute this one. You need to pay attention to this. If this happens, you definitely need to drop everything you're doing and get on it, whatever. Mm-hmm. So muting some of those things. Now, some chats I obviously don't mute, like the MoodleNet HQ team chat, because that's my team and that's the main chat. But if someone puts like five messages in a row in there in something that it could have just thought about and put one message, that's my wrist vibrating five times. And with the greatest will in the world, I do not want that to happen.
No, I think that's a really interesting point, isn't it? So if you look at the way of using chat apps like WhatsApp and the like, is that some people will write a whole paragraph and send it once. Other people will write 12 messages and send each line of the paragraph individually, like they're having like you're sitting next to them in a pub. And it's an interesting thing. You can't go and tell somebody off for the way they use a chat app kind of thing. And but as you say, when you get into a professional realm, you get into exactly that, which is, I mean, Twitter took care of that because it has its 140 characters. So people were playing with that. I know it's more now, but
I've written some stuff on this just as I was researching MoodleNet. This was one of the things, because Martin, who I've just mentioned before, MoodleNet was his idea. He saw the need for this. But one of the things we did during the design sprint was based on the research I did and saying, well, look, there are these two classes of social apps. Which one do we want to be more like? Because on a straight up messaging app, you can see when someone else is typing. Is that what we want MoodleNet to do? And we decided, well, maybe in future, but to start off with, probably not. And you have to think about, well, what are forums for? How are they different to instant messaging? How is that different from a public network like Instagram or Twitter? And it becomes, you know, quite interesting because there's different norms on there. Some of these norms are just ubiquitous across how that particular app is used. And some of them are quite niche depending on the culture of the organization and the people, the people in there. What I thought was really interesting, you know, on Twitter, how you've got those three little icons next to your name, and so have I.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I noticed that when Karen joined Telegram, I think she was already using Telegram, but she put three little things to represent herself there as well.
Oh, right, okay. She migrated that idea.
As if that's the thing to do. So you kind of build these cultures over time. And
he was probably just kissing ass to get the job, but yeah.
I don't think she's that kind of woman, to be quite.
Okay, I'm just joking. I don't know. People do all sorts of crazy stuff. But I saw a really interesting tweet today about somebody explaining how email worked to their children. And they said, but how do you know that somebody has read your message? I don't understand. Why would you use this as opposed to a text message? Where's the feedback? And you don't know if somebody's replying to you. And the point being is that as the chat apps become more standardized than email, the functionality does not meet the needs of the users because the users are familiar with being in a sort of constant feedback loop or certain feedback points within the communications loop cycle that tell them what's going on. You know, it's good to know whether someone's read your message, whether they've seen it, whether it's been delivered, whether they're typing back, whether they're on or not.
It is. It's a bit of a different shift, isn't it, in terms of how we deal with things. What's really interesting for me, my team, the rest of my team doesn't work as many days for Moodle as I do. They do, well, when their new contracts start, they'll all be doing 2.5 and I do 4.
Uh-huh.
So I try and be, I mean, it's difficult for people to picture this because most of the people listening to this, I guess, even if they work remotely, might work with their colleagues full time. But I try and make it as flexible as possible. And part of that I do feel slightly guilty for because all of the members of my team work more days than they're paid for, really, because they love what they're doing and the stuff that needs doing. I mean, it's not me cracking the whip particularly. But sometimes I forget that they're not working that day. And so it's really awkward because I know that they've seen the message, but they're not replying. And then I have to remember, oh yeah, it's because they're not working today. And then I have to apologize and stuff. So there is a bit of a, I know that my wife and her friends, you have to be very careful that if a notification comes up on your phone, not to click on it until you're ready to reply, because then the other person doesn't see it as read, and then you can claim that you never saw it before the thing happened, and then legitimately get out the thing that someone else is asking you to do. Like, it's just this whole thing.
Yes, exactly. And so you've got all of that with I think that's absolutely right. Is that people have to adjust their needs, but it's also, these apps are only developed, they've developed very generically, aren't they? So they're not developed with that kind of sensitivity in mind, which is, but if isn't it the case though, that you can turn that off on WhatsApp? I think it is. You don't use WhatsApp. And I think on WhatsApp, you can turn it off, but if you turn it off for yourself, as in no one can see if you've read or if you're replying or whatever, then you can't see that about anybody else either.
Yeah, and that's true of Twitter DMs as well. I've turned that off on Twitter because I don't really care.
Yeah, so that's it.
But I mean, it's amazing that if it's only taken 18 months, no, a bit more than that, maybe 2 years for my life to be, a lot of my online life is spent in Telegram now.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Can you share files and stuff like that? Because I just use
it. Yeah, it's super quick and it syncs across all your devices.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. Because I've been looking, I mean, the thing we're looking at is Teams because we have a license for it. Mm. And it is, connects all the, you know, so for those who don't know Teams, Microsoft Teams is the chat app for the front end of Microsoft to replace email, really. But it also allows you to embed in the window where the chat goes, you can embed all kinds of files and websites and all, anything that you want to, lots and lots of different kinds of plugins, SharePoint as well. So SharePoint is the glue of all Microsoft products, and Teams is the front end, the new front end to that, to SharePoint, to their online presence, basically.
Look, Telegram only works for Moodle because most people who work for Moodle are in some way technical. Like, you could not suggest that, you know, a school or a university or whatever runs the synchronous comms off Telegram. It would be crazy. The upside is that, you know, if you do have Microsoft, I think Microsoft Teams, but definitely Slack, if you pay for Slack, then the management can view direct messages between members on that Slack. Whereas Telegram, you're using your personal account, basically. So, you know, the rest of my team could set up a channel without me in there, and I'd have no idea.
Mm-hmm. No, it's quite interesting because that's always the distinction about, particularly about chat apps, that you need to be able to go and see what direct messages were sent, what's been deleted, to protect everybody involved in a conversation in case there becomes some kind of legal situation, disciplinary situation or whatever. And particularly in a school, that becomes incredibly important, sort of thing. So that's what we can do with email, is we can go and check on all the messages that have been sent, check the logs. We can go and log into somebody's inbox and see what's gone on.
But I do think for any kind of, I think people do this anyway, probably using WhatsApp, but you know, for people who, I found this, I was in Portugal a couple of weeks ago and got the apartment through booking.com, and she said, oh, I couldn't talk to you on WhatsApp. And I was like, yeah, because I don't use any Facebook products. And she was like, oh, okay. But the assumption that you're going to be on WhatsApp and that at any point you can just start a group message conversation or a direct message conversation with anyone, it's almost, as you say, becoming like the WeChat for the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. I think it is. So that's it. That is what's going on, and it's only going to get more so as well. It'd be wrong to mention WhatsApp really without talking about the vulnerabilities that have been exposed in it over the last, or since we last spoke. And so there's been two. There was that day. Was it a Friday night when WhatsApp, all Facebook products went down, and Twitter as well. That was a big deal. And then there was the vulnerability that was called a no-click attack. Basically, somebody who had your number and wanted to target you could install software on your phone without you clicking anything via the 40s.
You didn't even have to answer the phone, did you?
Yeah. So they just ring you, and that ringing would install whatever worm on your phone.
And the stuff I read about this, I don't know about you, but they were saying that, you know, this is kind of backdoor by design. Like, there's no reason why it should be like that. But the reason that they have it, it's quite, yes, end-to-end encrypted, but it's got so many vulnerabilities because that's the kind of backdoors that Facebook want, and certainly the security authorities want too.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. So I've got a couple of friends to switch over some chat groups, the major ones that I use in my life, to Telegram from WhatsApp after that, because it's not until these vulnerabilities are seen that people start to think, oh, actually, is my stuff not safe? Because a lot of the chat is not safe for work, if you like. And it's not something you'd want any, you know, many people in your life knowing about, because they're chatting with me, which means it's all pretty...
Are you using secret chats in Telegram then?
No. There's no need to do that. It's just being on an app that's not being targeted.
Right.
You know what I mean, I think that's the only thing.
That's another thing that Martin said, that Telegram is pretty much blocked in China, which he sees as another reason to use it, really.
Really?
Well, it means that there must be something which the Chinese government can't get to if it's going to be blocked.
Well, yeah, I think so. But it's also a bit dependent on... wow, did you see the thing that happened today, actually? Speaking of Chinese organizations, so Huawei have been...
blacklisted, yeah.
By Android, by Google. So they're only allowed access to the actual open source sections of the operating system. And Google are basically saying you are not allowed, they're not allowed to use the code for whatever. I don't know where the open source bit stops and Google continue, if you know what I mean.
Well, I mean, it's easy. As somebody who has, you know, installed things like Lineage OS and stuff on the phone, which is using AOSP, which is Android Original Source Project, that gulf between what you get on, say, I don't know, my wife's new Google Pixel 3 or our OnePlus devices or whatever, and AOSP, that gulf is getting wider. But it's not like Huawei can't do their own version. It's just a bit of a ball ache for them.
Well, to be honest, I was talking about this to some students. I'm really surprised that Samsung haven't brought out their own. Do you know what I mean? Even if they start with the AOSP, as you just called it, even if they started with that and then built on top of that, it would be something. But they don't.
Well,
they did try.
They used something called Tizen, which was a separate open source thing, which didn't really take off. But it's difficult. I mean, it's not. There's a reason why there's only two main flavors of operating system. It's a difficult thing to do, because what you have to do is create either complete binary compatibility with iOS or Android, or persuade developers to create apps for a third marketplace.
Indeed, which is where Microsoft, I mean, I've heard many people say that they love Microsoft phones, particularly techie people. It's their choice of phone, but obviously it's been deprecated now.
And if you're, I mean, for example, with MoodleNet, yeah, so everything we want to do with MoodleNet realistically can be done in a web app, especially a progressive web app, which is one that you can effectively install on your phone. You'll have seen this before. Twitter does it as well. If you go to a website like Twitter on a modern phone browser, it will say, would you like to install this app to your home screen? And what you're doing there is not downloading it from the Google Play Store or whatever. It's installing it as a progressive web app and storing some of the data offline. Mm-hmm. So that's what we ideally would do with MoodleNet. But of course, you get people saying, oh, it's an app. I can't find it in the Google Play Store. And then, of course, scammers come along and call something MoodleNet, and then they install that, and then that's not the real one and whatever. So you're just onto a loser straight away if you don't put an app in one of the big app stores.
I think that's right. It's I'm just trying to remember back in the day. So we're looking, 10 years ago, maybe somewhere getting towards that. Facebook, you know, when HTML5 first came out, and so Flash had gone and all of that. And then HTML5 was the new standard that was being agreed upon by all the big tech corps, and they were getting together and meeting and developing around it. But the development was slower than any of them wanted. And Facebook were committed to building their services in HTML5. And then at a certain point, they were just having so many bugs, and so it was speed issues, so refresh issues, I think it was, and that they had to abandon it and build in the native operating system code. And but now it's back the other way. So I don't have Instagram on my phone. I logged into it on the web on my phone the other day, and just to see what was going on, and it was really fast and really good, really impressive, to be honest. Yeah.
And if you are listening to this and you don't particularly like Twitter, I installed Twitter for the first time in a while on my phone for the Thinking Digital conference, and the web version is quite different, or has been quite different.
Okay.
It's a lot of an experience. So that is that. Yes. Okay. So one thing I did while in our little interregnum was the two things. So I gave up Thought Shrapnel for Lent, which I may have talked about in the last podcast. I can't remember. But I did decide just before Lent I was going to do that.
I don't think so. I can't remember.
And then when I finished Lent, I brought it back in a slightly different format. So for those who don't know what Thought Shrapnel is, thoughtshrapnel.com, it has been a newsletter, basically. And then it became a website which had articles which were then curated into a newsletter. And then people start supporting it on Patreon, and there's, 50-odd people on Patreon supporting it. And I thought, actually, what I want to do here is not spend ages making the newsletter. What I want to spend ages doing is doing the writing. I want to not just comment on one article. I want to bring together lots of different articles and have my take on this. And then if people want to read more on this subject, have a few more links. So what I'm doing now is every day there is an article that goes on Thought Shrapnel that has at least three links in the main body and quotations and all that kind of stuff on a particular area. It might be AI, it might be screen time and parenting or whatever it is. And then there's three links at the bottom as well. So at least, 6-7 links every day with commentary and analysis and things. And then on the day that the post comes out, that goes out by email and is accessible by anyone who supports me for any amount of money on Patreon. And then a week later, everyone else gets access to it. It's on the open web. And that seems to be working okay, actually. And I'm using a few different plugins for WordPress for that. And I'm actually really enjoying writing because every day I've got a deadline. Sometimes I write two posts a day and give myself a day off or whatever. But it's quite a nice discipline to get to because I feel like I'm adding value rather than just repeating what other people have said.
No, I think that's fair enough. So what's the purpose? So are you trying to make money out of this then? The purpose of you delaying your publication of posts, as in publishing public
people to support me on Patreon. If I'm not trying to make money per se, because most of the money I make on Patreon, I actually give away on Patreon and to the people I support, like the Electronic Frontier Foundation and stuff. So I would say that in terms of balance of payments, I'm probably actually giving more money to other people who create stuff that I like than the money I'm getting from people. But I was quite taken, I think I've said this before, by Gráinne Hamilton joined our co-op last year, and she was talking about, instead of seeing money as being what you're worth, seeing it as an exchange of energy. Because I when I started Thought Shrapnel, I honestly thought that I'd be inspiring and encouraging other people to also set up their own newsletter, their own blog, that kind of thing. But that hasn't really happened that much. And so if people really like my stuff, then even if it's a dollar a month, I don't really care. It's some way of showing that they appreciate the stuff that I'm doing and they want me to continue doing it. Now, I'm not going to get rich doing it, and that's not really the point. My point is that I've got, over 1,500 people subscribing to Thought Shrapnel. When I do surveys, everyone says they like it. But then you get like 3-4% of people actually supporting you in doing that. I just think it's a bit odd. I'm not really bothered about the money. I'm just interested in the backing, the support, that kind of thing.
Yeah. It's the truth of the web, isn't it, as well? If people aren't paying for it, you don't really know that they care about it in any way, shape or form, or they're indeed actually reading it. So so you're doing all of this stuff. I always think there's lots of stuff on the web is that you spend a long time building something, putting something together, what you've worked out, A, in a good design, and B, to be good content that people want or you think should be out there. But you don't really know what the engagement is. So the fact that 1,500 people subscribe to Thought Shrapnel, you don't know how many people are reading it particularly. And
the question is, I don't track people because I don't think that's something that, just because you can do something doesn't mean that you necessarily...
No, it's a bit like Tide. We don't do Tide because people are telling us they want more of this or they want more of that. Although, we're obviously happy to hear what anyone's got to say. But we do it because our motivation is between you and I, kind of thing.
Hmm. there was interest. I went for, I had an awful migraine last night. I went to bed early and thought, you know, I'm going to have to go for a run this morning just to clear my head. And there was an episode of the guy from Freakonomics, Stephen Dubner, was on a podcast called Work Life with Adam Grant, which I think I've mentioned on here before. And this particular episode was called Fad Busting. So I'll put the link in here.
Busting?
It's called Fad Busting.
Fad Busting.
So it was talking about like learning styles and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I've now completely lost my train of thought. What were we talking about just there?
You were talking about it because you listened to it because you had a migraine.
Yeah, and then before that, we were talking about some other stuff. And Stephen Dubner, in this episode, was talking about a thing. And if you listen to it, you'll see the link between what we've just been talking about and that, because my train of thought has departed, like the middle-aged senile man I'm becoming.
Oh, my gosh, harsh.
I know.
Don't worry, you're nowhere near as old as I am. No, I can't remember what you were talking about before. Sorry.
Anyway, let's move on to the next thing. So, Dyke, you remember when you and I went up a mountain?
I do remember when we went up a mountain. What fun that was.
It was great. We should do it again. In fact, I've only got a few more days to do now. So I've done Quality Mountain Day 16, which means I've got 4 left to do. And this time, drum roll, I took my son. And for those of you who follow this podcast all the way along, it's taken me forever to do these Quality Mountain Days. I have to do 20 to even get on the mountain leader course. And it takes ages because, you know, I travel a bit. And so coming back and saying, oh, I'm just going to bugger off for the weekend again, doesn't always go down so well with my wife, although she has accompanied me on a couple. And the whole point of doing this was so that I wasn't the idiot who dies on the side of a mountain while showing my son how to, you know, do these walks. And so this one, he wanted to come along, and he's now of an age, you know, he's getting towards 12 and a half, and, you know, he's a big, strong lad. He does lots of different sports, etc. And so we planned this route, and we stayed over at the Ambleside Youth Hostel, and we planned the route together, and we decided to go up a Helvellyn past, if you know the area, Fairfield, Dollywagon Pike, Nethermost Pike, etc. We didn't do Striding Edge, even though it was a lovely day, because I thought that would be too much. But actually, after reading about it afterwards, going down Swirl Edge is actually even worse, which is what we did.
Yeah, no, I walked Striding Edge to meet one of my groups on TV last summer. Moment, so it was nice. I did it barefoot. It was all right. It was hard work, though.
All right, Mr. Hardcore.
All right, there it is. So I didn't go up Helvellyn, though. So.
Right, so we did this 17-kilometer walk, which, you know, it's up and down and whatever. And he was fantastic. And I'd definitely do it with him again. I had such a great time. And a bit like on our walk, die just talking about life, the world and everything. And it was, you know, it was just perfect walking weather as well. Really had a fantastic time.
Sounds perfect. Sounds really good.
Yeah, really, really good. So I wrote that up and it's on my blog and you can see some pictures and things as I always do. So I'm going to go and try and finish off the rest of the 4 that I've got to do as soon as possible. And then I've got the problem of trying to get on the mountain leader course. Now, the mountain leader course is a 5-day course. It basically would take up one of my working weeks, which is a difficult thing to do when you're, you know, a product manager. And I'm going to go away for 2 weeks in the summer. So the other thing you can do is you can do 3 weekends. But unfortunately, those weekends, you have to be available for them. And all my kids do activities and stuff. So I'm currently struggling to find a time when I can do the actual mountain leader course. So that might be another delay, but never mind.
Yeah, it's tricky, but I mean, that's the point really, isn't it? Is that you have to sacrifice to do it.
I know. Other things I've done, I was the MC at the MoodleMoot UK and Ireland in Manchester. I also did a presentation on MoodleNet, and I chaired sessions and I ran a workshop on MoodleNet as well. That was good, although I was knackered afterwards. And did I tell you about my neighbour giving me... You see, there's some stuff, Di, that we've talked about that I can't remember if it's on the podcast.
Yeah, go on.
I don't think I've talked about this. My neighbour, so CBD is the it's basically the bit of cannabis that doesn't get you high. CBD.
Yeah. CBD oil, yeah, absolutely.
So one of my neighbors bought a whole pallet of these CBD drinks, because CBD itself does not taste very nice. These drinks, like energy drinks, basically, with CBD and 10 milligrams of CBD. And she said, you know, I know that you get migraines. I thought that these might help. So I tried them and it's great. Like, it doesn't stop migraines when I've got one, but if I'm feeling migraine, it stops me. And I often get migraines at conferences. And so I took these cans along with me and I took one, I had one every day and I didn't get a migraine, which was incredible given the amount of stuff I was doing there. So really happy about that. And I've since actually bought CBD oil, which you put underneath your tongue and it tastes awful. But yeah, good way if you suffer from anything from anxiety to migraines or loads of stuff, it's supposed to help all of that.
Yeah, so CBD oil, D oil is a muscle relaxant. So THC is a psychoactive agent in marijuana or cannabis or whatever. And CBD is a muscle relaxant that goes alongside it. So it's part of feeling all chilled and, adds to the feeling. And one of the problems with skunk and modern cannabis drugs is that they are too psychoactive. They've been laced to be very THC heavy and not so much on the CBD. And people love this because they feel like they're really getting wasted. But they're actually the thing... I watched this really, oh my gosh, Doug, I need to tell you about this. I watched this documentary on some popular television streaming service, either Prime or Netflix, I can't remember which, called The Grass is Greener. And Snoop Dogg's in there and lots of other people. But it gives the history of cannabis use. And there's some really, really shocking revelations in there about how cannabis came to get its name, basically, and how it became criminalized and illegal and everything under Nixon and when he was American president and things like that. And because of the change in civil rights laws, they were unable to target certain sections of the population. So instead, they criminalized the activities of those sections of the population so they could...
Oh, wow.
They could go after them safely within the law. It's a fascinating thing, and it's not conspiracy theory. It's all very well researched, and it talks about where a lot of the jazz greats like Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong and people like that, they all talk about jive, and jive is a reference to cannabis. And reefer a lot as well. They sing songs about them that were in the top of the charts kind of thing back in the day or whatever, you know, very popular music at the time. And before it was criminalized, and then it became criminalized sometime in the 60s, whenever it was. Absolutely fascinating. I recommend anybody give it a watch. There's lots of interesting documentaries. So one of the things that this sort of new culture or new platforms of television are providing is a lot of self-made or self-sponsored television shows, and a lot of them are documentaries, and they're sort of really, really interesting because you get these groups of people that go and find pertinent and undisclosed areas of our societies and go and expose them with good research and all that sort of thing. And I guess you have to take it with a pinch of salt in one respect because they're looking for clickbait or viewing bait. But this is a really, really good documentary. Recommend watching it.
Good stuff. Well, I've never used cannabis recreationally, apart from CBD. But
Have you only used it professionally?
So anyway, moving swiftly on, I was in Lisbon for the first time, and my good friend Brian Mathers was there, and I introduced him to the crazy world of electric scooters, of which there are many in Lisbon.
I'm so desperate. It would be perfect for me to have an electric scooter where I work and live right now. It would be so fantastic.
Private land, it's not illegal.
Yeah, but my school doesn't just live on private land, sadly.
No one's going to arrest you, die, I'm going to say.
Oh, no, it's going to be absolutely fine. I agree, but you can't, that's not a reason to break the law.
Oh, right.
When you're a teacher. So you'd soon be found out, and I would be hauled into somebody's office somewhere. I don't know who's.
No, fair enough. But so it's interesting because in Lisbon, which I've known, have you been to Lisbon?
No, I haven't actually.
Well, you can't get there direct from Newcastle Airport. So I had to go via Dublin. And then because I've been to Dublin lots of times, I knew that I could get to the Chester Beatty Gallery, the museum, which I love because it's all Japanese and Oriental art and stuff, on the bus, spend an hour there, go to the amazing Silk Road Cafe, and then come back in time to then get my next flight to, so Newcastle, Dublin, and then Dublin to Lisbon. And then Laura Hilliger, hi Laura, if you're listening, said you must stay or you must visit LX Factory. And then Mayel on my team also said, oh, you must go to LX Factory. So LX Factory was this, I guess, several factories. And it was abandoned. It had workers' houses around it and apartments and stuff. And then all of the artists and everyone, the crazy people moved in. And then it's become this kind of like hipster place with cafes and good food and music and whatever. And so I arrived at this apartment, which I booked on booking.com. Really good reviews. And the apartment itself was fantastic. But like trying to get to sleep was really noisy. I didn't think that the street outside was very busy. And when I woke up in the morning, Lisbon's got this bridge, a bit like the Golden Gate Bridge. And that bridge basically goes over the top of the top floor apartment where I was. And it's actually two bridges. It's the train bridge and the road bridge. So very, very noisy. And then this apartment was basically backing on to LX Factory. And then on the Friday and Saturday night, there was live music, but the music was fantastic and it was really loud. So I just opened the windows and it was like having a band in the apartment. It was amazing.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. The conference was
It sounds really cool. It's always awesome when you're there in a place at a point in its development, which is where it's just got it all going on and, you know, people are just bringing good work there basically.
So Brian and I were bombing around on electric scooters. The conference itself, like the Creative Commons Summit, is a weird mixture of people who are into reforming copyright law and very creative people and educators. And it's a weird kind of mix of people. The CEO of Creative Commons is Ryan Merkley, who I worked with at Mozilla, as and some of the Mozillians there as well. Like just a whole bunch of really interesting people, really. Just everyone was very interesting.
That's cool. It's good.
And I've already talked about Thinking Digital, which is where I was last week. So all good stuff.
Very good. What should we talk about next?
Well, I just want to talk about MoodleNet really quickly, because the last time I will have mentioned anything on Tide about MoodleNet, well, we'll have just finished the second, or just be finishing the second round of testing.
That's right. I remember, yeah.
Yeah, so we're now on version 0.9.3 to be released tomorrow. There's 250-300 people on there, obviously not using it all the time. It's looking a bit more like a thing. And the particular issue we've got at the moment is federation. So for those who have forgotten or don't know what this is like Mastodon or Pleroma or PixelFed or all these new kind of apps. And in the same way, we talked about email, in the same way that I don't have to worry about whether, you know, an email I sent to Dai is going to work. It just, because it's based on open standards. It's a bit like you can't send a message from Facebook to Twitter or Instagram to LinkedIn or whatever. But a lot of these new social networks are based on a protocol called ActivityPub, which is what we're doing with MoodleNet. That federation means that if you set up your own version of MoodleNet for your university or organization, whatever, then the stuff that you share on there can also be seen on all the different federated networks, and not just MoodleNet, but all the other ones that use the same protocol. And that is a particularly difficult thing to do, especially given that we're the first people to be doing that for a resource-centric social network. So, interestingly, our back-end developer, Alex, we basically came, he resigned, but it basically came to a mutual understanding that we needed someone else to do this. And so we've replaced Alex, and today was their first day, with two people, with James and Karen. James is British, based in the Netherlands. Karen is Czech and lives in Prague. And they're going to do different elements of the back-end, 2.5 days each. So we should be really getting cracking on that. And I'm not promising anything, but by the end of the summer, you should be able to set up your own version of MoodleNet and test it out. So quite exciting.
Wow. Sounds good. It's a big lot of work.
It has.
Doug, I'm going to have to pause there because I have to go and deal with something in-house. Someone's had to go to the health center.
I'm going to press pause.
Yeah. Cool.
All right, so you're back. Is everything okay?
Yeah, a little fracas got in-house, which I'm going to need to go and deal with soon.
Right. Okay, well, let's finish this off and go from there.
Cool.
So where were we? I was talking about MoodleNet, yada, yada, yada. And then there's a whole bunch of links that I put in the Google Doc for tonight.
Yeah, no, this is the problem. Lots of the stuff that you've been, so I read for Shrapnel as it comes through every week. And lots of stuff's been really, really interesting. And I'm just looking for what it is that I've read that I've really, really liked, but I can't for a moment. So we've got things like teens not damaged by screen time, a study finds. But then you get technology cuts children off from adult, warns experts. That's from the BBC and the Guardian, respectively.
Well, this is the thing. So let's just talk about those two, right? So there's something in BBC Technology about, you know, actual research showing that teens aren't damaged by screen time and stuff. But then if you read the Guardian article, this is the kind of stuff you get in the Daily Mail and the Telegraph and the Times and stuff like that, which is based on anecdotes, basically. Like, oh, we've all seen kids are walking around with their faces glued to their phones and, like, I can't even talk to my child. They're just on Fortnite all the time. And you think, there's maybe something in that because, the you know, things are designed to be addictive. But I'm pretty sure teenagers used to not want to talk to their parents before Fortnite.
I think that's absolutely right. And there's this thing, isn't it, about whether these activities in phones particularly, you'd have to argue, are not the same, because adults are appropriating these things as well. So what we're getting into in the world of gaming, which is a lot of things that, you know, boys do a lot of gaming online, on their phones or on their devices and their screens, whatever, is that gaming, you know, people who gamed as children and big gamers who game for life, as it were, are now being parents. And they game for leisure and pleasure. You know, instead of watching telly, they're playing computer games. And one would have to argue that playing a computer game is better for you than sitting inertly and passively watching television, because you're interacting with a game, you have physiological responses on a regular basis, and you're moving and acting. And I had a really interesting conversation in relation to this about screen time recently, because I went down to Wellington College to have a look at they have a one-to-one program of Surfaces, Microsoft Surface Pros there. And I was talking to one of the classes for a few minutes and asked them what they thought about it. They'd done it for a couple of years. I said, how is a screen time? I said, now you're using screens in every lesson. You're using screens for your homework, screens for your leisure and pleasure, as well as all the things that you're required to use screens for to participate in society. And they were a bit jaded by that. They were forever with their eyes on screens, and they found it difficult. And I think that's a big consideration for education, really, is managing that time.
The thing, it's really difficult. And I've talked about being a parent in any age is difficult. But I've talked before about how with the best intentions in the world, you can want to do something as you as a parent, and then you have to negotiate that with your the other parent, if there is one, of the child. But then you don't exist in a vacuum. Your family exists in a wider societal, you know, school kind of thing. So you have to think about what's going on there too. And there's an article I've linked to, a Brookings article. It's called Children Need Digital Mentorship, Not WHO's Restrictions on Screen Time. And the guy who wrote this, Jordan Shapiro, he has written a book, and his book is called The New Childhood, Raising Kids to Thrive in a Connected World, which I haven't read. But he says, and I'll just quote this bit near the end of the article, he says, "The answer is not more limits and restrictions. It's more mentorship and guidance. When we treat screens as forbidden fruit, we reinforce the idea that digital play is an unhealthy temptation that kids enjoy alone, mischievously, and with a bit of guilt and shame. That's a problem because children need help learning how to engage in positive online behaviors, how to manifest the values we care most about through digital modes of communication, and how to be good citizens of a connected world," end of quote. Now, I am absolutely guilty of restricting my children's screen time. In fact, Di, before we started...
Doug, I'm going to have to go.
Yep.
Sorry, my doorbell's ringing like...
Well, I'm going to finish off that thought. Okay, you go, Di. Just to finish off this podcast then, the point I wanted to make is that before starting this podcast, I was telling Di that I have restricted my children's amount of time. So usually they get an hour on their tablets per day and they're allowed to go on the games consoles at the weekend. But I have found recently that they're coming in from school, barely acknowledging us as parents, going straight on their devices and trying to get to that, you know, hour of being on their tablets. So the new compact, the new deal, is that they've got half an hour, and if they do something like Duolingo or Khan Academy or something, then they get another half an hour. Now, I don't quite like that idea particularly, but especially because when I got my first computer, it was in my bedroom, and I read all kinds of crazy stuff on the internet, as it was back then, 1997, 96, whatever. All kinds of crazy stuff. Looked at stuff I shouldn't have looked at, everything like that. But the world is even, you know, it's not like just a few conspiracy theories here and there in text or the occasional image. It's, you know, it's mainly videos. It's all that kind of stuff. Now today, which is May the 20th, 2019, Moodle 3.7 came out. And to accompany Moodle 3.7, there's all these little videos showing all the features and everything like that. So I thought I'd have a look at them because they're put together by my talented colleague, Mary Cooch, who some of you might know if you listen to this. Now, when I looked at this video, and this video has literally come out today, and my viewing history is not radical crazy stuff on YouTube. This Moodle 3.7 video about the new badges features in Moodle, the next recommended video for me, which would autoplay after that is finished, is a video featuring David Icke, you know, the person who thinks that the UK monarchy are actually reptiles from outer space, saying how climate change is a hoax. And it's, as a parent, it's difficult not to want to kind of shield your kids from that. And I fully recognize that actually you have to educate them and stuff, but there's so much stuff going on at the same time. It's easier just to block it, limit it, do whatever. So I do have conversations and that kind of thing, but it is really difficult to be a parent and to know what's going on, even if you feel like you're one of the more enlightened ones, etc. Anyway, there is one more thing I want to share, and I know Di's not here, so I'm effectively having a conversation with myself here. But I wanted to share one more, which again is kind of about parenting, but if you're an educator, you'll be interested in this as well. This was an article in the Washingtonian, and it's entitled, What Happened After My 13-Year-Old Son Joined the Alt-Right? So this scares me to death. So I've just mentioned that, you know, when I was 14 years old, whatever, I was on the internet by myself at a time when I wasn't even supposed to be. I was pretending to be my dad and signing up for CompuServe and AOL membership. So my parents didn't even know I was online. But this is a 13-year-old kid, and you have to read the article, but basically ended up moderating a Reddit forum for alt-right adults and everything like that. And then they coached him on how to approach his parents to allow him to join an alt-right rally. So the parents basically lost him to the alt-right, but then managed to bring him back as well. And it's just a very scary, but also eye-opening article in terms of the way that the world is now for kids and kind of the new normal. And then actually the new normal is in the title for this one, which I'll share as well, which is Sonny Livingston, who is at the London School of Economics Department of Media and Communications. She's done some work with Common Sense Media, who I've mentioned a lot before. And it says, what's the new normal for parents and teens online? Common Sense Media launches UK research. And there's a lot of interesting stuff in there talking about parents and families and how we balance digital and other activities. So much stuff I want to talk about in there. So many things, but I'm going to have to leave them for another time because this has been Tide episode 117, which started with Di and me and has ended with just me. So until next time, thank you for listening to Tide. And please do give us feedback if you're interested in any of these articles, if you've got suggestions, any kind of feedback at all. Otherwise, we live in a bit of a feedback void. Watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on a dock of a bay, wasting time.